Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations, Religion, and Foreign Policy conference call series. I'm Irina Fasganis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Eboo Patel with us to discuss his new book, Sacred Ground, Pluralism, Prejudice, and the Promise of America, as well as his work as a Muslim interfaith advisor to the Obama administration. Dr. Patel is also the author of Acts of Faith, The Story of an American Muslim, The Struggle for the Soul of a Generation, which won the Louisville Grawemeyer Award in Religion. He has been a regular contributor to The Washington Post, USA Today, and CNN. He served on the President Obama's Inaugural Advisory Council of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, and holds a doctorate in sociology of religion from Oxford University, where he studied on a Rhodes Scholarship. He is the founder and president of the Interfaith Youth Corps, which is based in Chicago. Eboo, thanks very much for being with us today. It would be great if you could get the conversation started by offering your insights on religious diversity and pluralism that you discovered while writing your book that I mentioned before, Sacred Ground.
Great.
So over to you.
Irina, thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this call, and thank you to so many of you for joining. I see lots and lots of friends on this list, and just about everyone on this list is a fellow traveler in building interfaith cooperation in America and beyond, so I'm delighted to be with you this afternoon. So I want to begin by saying that even a brief glance at Foreign Affairs or at the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal on any given day gives us a palpable sense that the question of how communities who orient around religion differently relate to each other with the nations and regions is one of the great questions of our time. You can ask the question when it comes to emerging democracies, for example. In Tunisia, how will the Sufis and the Salafis of Tunisia build a nation together? In Egypt, how will the Christians and the various type of Muslims, from secularists to the Muslim Brotherhood to liberal Muslims there, build a nation together? How will the Sunnis and Shias of Bahrain build a nation? And even in countries that we think of that where we do not normally think of religious diversity, for example, in Myanmar, there's a significant challenge between some of the Buddhist population of that nation and the Rohingya Muslims. How will that nation's 135 different religious and ethnic groups build a nation together? The United States has had a remarkably positive history when it comes to religious pluralism. Let me define what I mean by religious pluralism. It's far more than mere tolerance, and it's also different than diversity. Harvard scholar Diana Eck reminds us that the term diversity simply refers to a demographic fact, the fact of people of different backgrounds living in close quarters, but it says nothing about how those people relate to one another. When we use the term pluralism at Interfaith Youth Corps, we mean it in a variety of ways. Number one, the sense that there's respect for different groups in that society. Different groups have their identities respected, have a sense of they are free to practice their traditions, free to open their houses of worship. There is a broad appreciative knowledge of that community in the society. We would list all of that under respect for identity. Second, that there are positive relationships between different communities within a society. So Catholics and Protestants, Muslims and Jews, Hindus and humanists, all within a nation like America, there will be positive relationships between those communities. And finally, that there's a commitment to the common good. There's a commitment to building a stronger nation, a commitment to building a stronger city. Whatever kind of the broader definition of community is outside of one's own parochial or particular sense of community, there is a commitment to making that entity, city, campus, state, nation, region, stronger. So it's a three-part definition of pluralism: respect for diverse identities, relationships between different communities, and a commitment to the common good. A couple of other ways we think about pluralism at Interfaith Youth Core is this notion of welcoming the contributions of a variety of communities and nurturing cooperation between them. And finally, a sense that people from different backgrounds should live together with equal dignity and mutual loyalty. All of those are a variety of understandings of pluralism that are in the same family, that speak to appreciation, that speak to positive relationship, that speak to common good. And Sacred Ground, this book that I've recently published, is about the American experience of pluralism. And one of the things that I realized in writing this book is that the pluralism that so many of us enjoy today didn't fall from the sky and didn't rise from the ground. It was built, and it was frequently built in the teeth of a very different ethic. And there's a dynamic that I identify across American history that I call the forces of pluralism versus the forces of prejudice. And a big part of what I try to do in this book is lift up key moments in that dynamic. And I just want to give you one example that I write about in Sacred Ground. Even before America was a nation, in the 1650s, when New York was still New Amsterdam under Dutch control, the director general of that city, a man named Peter Stuyvesant, banned Quaker prayer meetings. Said that Quakers were rabble-rousers and seducers of the people. For anybody that's been to a Quaker prayer meeting, that's somewhat laughable, and I used to go regularly when I was a student at Oxford to the Friends Society meetings on Sunday mornings. But this was kind of par for the course in many nations at the time, the viewing of a particular religious group as dangerous and the banning of their prayer practice. This is the forces of prejudice on the rise. Well, in Flushing, a little hamlet outside of New Amsterdam, which is now, of course, a part of the borough of Queens in broader New York City, a group of about 30 ordinary citizens and minor officials, none of whom were Quaker, decided that they weren't going to stand for Director General Stuyvesant's ordinance. And they came together and they created something called the Flushing Remonstrance, which many historians say was the first stake in the ground for religious freedom in the land that would become America. And as I read through the Flushing Remonstrance, I noticed something far more robust and frankly beautiful than just a sense of religious freedom. I got the sense of what Martin Luther King Jr. later referred to as building a beloved community. There are lines in the Remonstrance which go like this: the law of peace, of love, peace, and liberty in the states extending to Jews, Turks, and Egyptians, as they are considered sons of Adam. Whatsoever form, name, or title he appears in, whether Presbyterian, Independent, Baptist, or Quaker, we shall be glad to see anything of God in any of them. This is, for me, as powerful an example as any of the forces of pluralism meeting and ultimately defeating the forces of prejudice. And again, this notion that this ought to be a nation that welcomes the contributions of diverse communities, that respects their diverse identities, that nurtures cooperation between them, that has a commitment to the common good. It's something that repeats itself a couple of centuries later during the rise of the Know Nothing Party. The Know Nothing Party was a party that was dominated by an anti-Catholic ethic. It emerges in the middle of the 19th century as a part of a huge anti-Catholic wave, and they elect many dozens of people to the U.S. Congress. Entire state legislatures in, for example, Massachusetts are composed almost entirely of know-nothing politicians. And there's this palpable sense that this party and the movement that it represents are going to banish Catholics and especially Catholic institutions from the United States. And one of the people who stood up against the Know-Nothing Party was Abraham Lincoln. One of the beautiful lines at that time, he said, kind of tongue-in-cheek, "Our progress in degeneracy appears to me to be pretty rapid. As a nation, we began by declaring that all men are created equal. We now practically read it, all men are created equal except black men. When the know-nothings get control, it will read, all men are created equal except black men and foreigners and Catholics." Again, this notion that the pluralism that we enjoy now in the United States even though there are prejudices, even though there are barriers, it was built by people who went before us, people who engaged the forces of prejudice of their time and who defeated those forces of prejudice. One of the things that occurred to me as I was writing this book in the offices of the president of Loyola University, a Catholic Jesuit school here in Chicago, at a time when we were sending my oldest son, Zaid, to a Catholic preschool, was just how widespread Catholic contribution to American civil society is. I feel this particularly personally because one of the reasons I'm in the United States at all is because Notre Dame University let in my father into their MBA program in the 1970s, and he was a Muslim immigrant from India at the time. And I think to myself, what if the Know-Nothing Party had won? What if the ethic that Catholics don't belong here had prevailed? What if the notion that every Catholic institution, every school, every hospital, every college, every social service agency is simply a Trojan horse with papal control riding within it? What if that had won the day? Think about how much poorer American civil society would be. There are approximately 600 Catholic hospitals in the United States. There are approximately 7,000 Catholic grade schools and high schools. There are approximately 230 Catholic college campuses. And that doesn't even count the amazing Catholic social service work that's done by organizations like my friend Larry Snyder, who's on this call, the head of Catholic Charities. A massive contribution to American civil society. And one could say the same thing when it comes to the Jewish contribution, the Quaker contribution, the Lutheran contribution, the rising Muslim contribution. The fact is, a huge part of American civil society is created and nurtured by religious communities and religious commitments. And so when we speak of American pluralism, we're not simply speaking of something ethereal. We're not simply speaking of a narrative of America as a nation that welcomes contributions. We're a nation that, in a very concrete way, relies on those contributions to power our civil society. Urban school districts would literally be unimaginable without Catholic schools. Catholic schools in which, in many cases, over 50% of that school is non-Catholic and caters particularly to urban minority populations. If there wasn't a robust Catholic school system here in Chicago, the Chicago public school system wouldn't know what to do because it would be overwhelmed with students who are currently part of the Catholic school system. And again, one could make the same case for the Jewish contribution to American civil society, the Lutheran contribution, the Baptist contribution, so on and so forth. I think part of the genius of America, part of the genius of our E Pluribus Unum, out of many one, is that in America you get to keep both sides of the hyphen, both Catholic and American, Muslim and American, Jewish and American, Hindu and American, Buddhist and American, and we've somehow created a society where both sides are mutually reinforcing. So, for example, it is a very Catholic thing to do to start a school that serves the broader population. In this case, what makes you a more faithful Catholic also makes you a more active American citizen. And that's part of the genius of our civil society, is that you can come plant your particular identity in American soil and grow an institution that serves the common good. And this is not something that one can expect to see in the same way around the world. In many places around the world, the civic institutions that are built by particular religious communities serve only the constituents of that religious community. But in the United States, we're able to articulate our particular identities in ways that serve the broader nation, a very powerful fact of our civil society. What does it mean to write the next chapter in the great story of American pluralism? And let's be frank, we live at a time in which religious prejudice is ripe, if not rampant. We are the most religiously diverse nation, some scholars say, in human history. We're the most religiously devout nation in the West at a time of global religious conflict. The forces of religious prejudice are not shy, whether those were the anti-Mormon forces questioning if Mitt Romney could be president of the United States 9 or 12 months ago, or whether they're the anti-Muslim forces called out by the Fear Incorporated report done by the Center for American Progress, or whether they're the small but continuing continuing and vociferous anti-Semitic and anti-Catholic and anti-atheist forces. The fact is religious prejudice still exists in America, and we have to ask the question, what does it mean to be the forces of pluralism, engaging those forces of prejudice and writing the next chapter in the history of American interfaith cooperation? So one of the byproducts of the last decade's worth of roiling religious controversy in the United States, whether it's Islamophobia or whether it's religious extremism or whether it's the terrible scandal of pedophilia amongst a small number of priests in the Catholic Church, is that a number of social scientists have started to take American religious diversity more seriously and done studies on it. And at Interfaith Youth Core, when we looked at those studies, we found that those social scientists tended to categorize religious diversity and people's responses to it in three categories: attitudes, relationship, and knowledge. We also realized that those social scientists saw that those three categories were deeply related. They made something that we call the interfaith triangle, the three sides being attitudes, relationships, and knowledge. And what we know based on social science data from Pew, from Gallup, from Robert Wussnow at Princeton, from Robert Putnam at Harvard, and David Campbell at Notre Dame, is if you have a positive, meaningful relationship with somebody from a different religious tradition, your attitudes towards that whole tradition improve. If you have appreciative knowledge of another religious tradition, your attitudes towards that whole community improve. What this shapes up into is a model for effectiveness in doing interfaith programming. I think one of the things we ought to be proud of as a nation in the last 10 years is there's been a dramatic growth in interfaith programming. But I think alongside growth needs to be a focus on effectiveness. And any social sector field worth its salt, whether it's literacy or poverty alleviation or climate change, has models of effectiveness. And I think as we do our work within our interfaith-oriented nonprofits or on our college campuses or within our faith-based social service agencies, and we realize the importance of interfaith cooperation, this idea that what we are trying to do is run programs that facilitate positive, meaningful relationships, that advance appreciative knowledge, such that people's attitudes are improved, is what we're going after. These are things that can be measured. These are things that when you work the interfaith triangle effectively multiple times, they build positive relationships such that we bridge and multiply our social capital in America. These are the kinds of things that we can submit to philanthropists, to foundations, to government agencies and say, we know that interfaith cooperation and religious pluralism are priorities of the United States and beyond, and we are running programs and initiatives that track metrics and that seek impact. I want to end with what I think the goal of our movement is, that movement being interfaith cooperation and writing the next chapter in the great story of American pluralism, with a line that ended the 1893 Parliament of the World's Religions held here in Chicago. From now on, the great religions of the world make war no longer on each other and instead on the giant ills that afflict humankind.
Thank you very much, Eva, for that terrific overview and perspective. Let's open up to the group for questions as well as comments.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press the star key followed by the 1 key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Our first question comes from Sheikh Ubaid.
Thank you so much, Mr. Patel, for such an informative and inspiring presentation. The rise of Islamophobia and its acceptance by the mainstream politicians is a major step backwards in America's journey towards, you know, pluralism and a better tomorrow. So how does the interfaith leadership counter it? Because the report that you mentioned, Fear Inc., it points out how well established and well financed the campaign of Islamophobia is. And similarly, we cannot expect much from the politicians, because today's media covered report by the former ambassador of U.S. to Pakistan, where he said that had the U.S. apologized for the killing of the Pakistani soldiers, it would have gone a long way in developing better relationship. And President Obama could not do that because of tremendous pressure from the right, from the Republican Party. So the politicians, either, you know, even the liberal politicians will come under great pressure to say the right things. So the job of the interfaith leadership becomes paramount. So how do they go about doing this?
So thank you for that question. So there's a section in my book where I compare and contrast Newt Gingrich and Michael Bloomberg. And I point out that Newt Gingrich in the 1990s, when he was Speaker of the House, was approached by a young Muslim congressional staffer, a fellow Republican, and said that told that there was a growing number of Muslim staff on Capitol Hill, and they needed a place to pray Juma prayers. And Newt Gingrich told this young man, Suhail Khan, that he, as the Speaker of the House and who controlled the space on the House side of the Capitol, would ensure that Suhail and his Muslim friends and colleagues had a place to pray every Friday afternoon. Of course, Mr. Gingrich, a decade later, looked very different as he became kind of the voice of the anti-Cordoba House initiative. But I think it's interesting to point out that the arc that Gingrich went through and the contrast between Gingrich and Michael Bloomberg in the summer of 2010. And Bloomberg, also a fellow Republican, was the most robust voice in favor of Cordoba House and on the side of the notion that Muslims ought to be able to not only worship where they want in the United States, as is protected by the Constitution, but also make a civic contribution. And the whole idea of Cordoba House, what became better known as the Ground Zero Mosque, was kind of this notion of a Muslim YMCA. So the reason I tell that story, Sheikh Ubaid, is to point out that actually there were politicians who, at great risk to themselves, and Bloomberg was reportedly to be considering a presidential run at the time, at great risk to themselves, stood up in favor of our broad principles as Americans of welcoming the contributions of different communities and in partnership with Muslims. And I think at this time, it's important for everybody to hold up those stories. I think it's especially important for Muslims to hold up those stories of people who sided with us at great risk to themselves in favor of American principles. And it's also important for Muslims to ask the question, who are we standing up for? Not just who is standing up for us, but who are we standing up for?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Suhag Shukla with Hindu American Foundation. I apologize. Our next question comes from Charles Stromer with Center for Public Justice.
Well, hello, Ibu. Thanks for being with us today. Appreciate your story. It's a good one. I like the distinction you make in Sacred Ground between diversity and pluralism. And the question I've got for you is a little bit tricky, so bear with me here on that subject. Even if you get everybody agreed in a community for a norm of religious pluralism and they're working together, there's still the issues of that come up in communities of, you know, trying to sit around a table together, Jews, Muslims, Christians, secular believers, trying to figure out the best way to solve a particular issue, right? So that's kind of been where my research has been for the last decade or so, trying to figure out an agency or a means by which people who have agreed to this norm of religious pluralism can come together and sit around the table and sort out problems in their community in the wisest ways possible. And I see a lot of potential for that in the Judeo-Christian tradition and the wisdom tradition. And I've been looking under the skin of that tradition to try to find out what makes that tradition tick, in the sense that if you look into the literature and the books of the wisdom tradition, you find it. Wisdom gives this agency for bringing people together who are different on common ground to sort of do the best they can in their pluralistic situations. So I've been taking that idea and trying to bring it to the Quran and into Islam as an outsider, and I don't find in the Quran sort of wisdom literature, wisdom books under which the skin I can go, but I've been finding Islamic concepts like, and forgive me if I don't pronounce these right, Ijtihad and Bani Adam, and concepts like that folks like yourself seem to be working with. Would you agree, or could you help me out here to or help us all out to think, are those Islamic concepts, would they fit into like this wisdom tradition to help people who are different, who have agreed on this norm of religious pluralism to come together? Does ijtihad and Bani Adam and those sorts of concepts fit in with that kind of thinking?
So thank you for that question, and I would say broadly yes. So Bani Adam means the tribe of Adam, and what it refers to is this notion that we have a single creator, God, and in the Islamic tradition, a single creator, God, and a single common ancestor, Adam, and we are all sons and daughters of Adam, and therefore a single family, and therefore to treat each other familially, right? And there's a number of things that would also kind of go under that category. A number of times in the Quran where it says, you know, argue with those who are different in the best of ways. So the first thing that that's doing is it's acknowledging difference, which is very important. It's not proposing that sameness is a goal, and it's saying here's the way you ought to engage with that difference in a positive way. Ijtihad refers to an interpretive tradition within the Quran, which I think is also related to diversity. As societies grow more diverse, how do you interpret the Muslim sources such that they engage, such that Muslims can engage positively with that diversity? I would say two essays, or three, let me give you and other friends on this call three essays to read, all of which you can find online and Google quite quickly. One is called Mercy, the Stamp of Creation by Dr. Omar Abdullah, maybe the senior Muslim scholar in the United States, and it highlights the importance of mercy as the central value in Islam and the quality with which human beings ought to treat each other, Muslims treating other Muslims and Muslims treating people who are outside of the tradition of Islam. So Mercy, the Stamp of Creation would be one article. A second article, also by Dr. Omar Abdullah, is Islam and the Cultural Imperative, and that is how the Muslim tradition ought to understand itself in ways that engages modern societies, including the diversity of those societies, and that would be along the lines of ijtihad, as you were talking. And the third is an essay by Khalid Abu El Fadl, a professor at UCLA. It's called The Place of Tolerance in Islam. And that's a reading of the verses in the Quran, both the ones that are intolerant, if you will, and the ones that are very open to pluralism, and asking the question, why should we privilege the ones that are open to pluralism? And one of the things that Professor Abu El Fadl says is because pluralism and mercy are central values in the Quran, we ought to lift up those verses that speak specifically to pluralism. So those are three essays that people can quickly go to, they can find online, that highlight these dimensions of the Muslim tradition.
Thanks very much, Ibo. Citing those sources is terrific. Thanks, man.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Next question or comment.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Suhag Shukla with Hindu American Foundation.
Hi, Ibo.
Hi, Suhag.
How are you?
I'm well.
I just wanted to ask, in your experience, how your students, especially on the college campuses, have dealt with religious exclusivism, because that's probably the major obstacle I see to kind of seeing a true manifestation of pluralism when people come in with the teaching, or they've been raised with a certain notion that theirs is the only way.
So at Interfaith Youth Corps, one of the things that we do, and we say this playfully but we mean it seriously, is that we separate heaven and earth, which is to say we recognize that it is doctrinal for many traditions to have exclusive views of heaven. Certainly would be the case in many expressions of Christianity and Islam, and also would be the case in some expressions of Hinduism and Buddhism, this notion of what you would call exclusive truth. We don't think it's helpful to have conversations about who's going to heaven at a table that is focusing on how we can partner positively to improve earth. So part of what we say is the ground rules for this table is that we're not going to proselytize or evangelize, although we respect the idea that that a variety of people at this table and the communities that they're a part of engage in such activities outside precisely because they do believe in exclusive truth. But what we're agreeing to at this table is that we are going to bring forth the dimensions of our traditions that seek positive relationships here on Earth. And I am firmly convinced that religious traditions can do both, because I've worked with this for the last 10 to 15 years, Catholics, evangelicals, fellow Muslims, who firmly believe in a particular view of heaven and a particular view of salvation, which I believe is their right, and certainly one reading of a religious tradition, but are very robust and positive partners here on Earth. So I think it's important unless the interfaith table is only going to be for those who are progressive theologically, which I don't think it ought to be. I think the interfaith table ought to be open to everybody who enters with the goodwill of partnership. I think that we just have to set the ground rules straight, that this is not a place of proselytization, but we recognize that many people who come to this table would be engaging in a variety of activities outside of this table that other people are going to disagree with. And I just think that that's the deal in living in a diverse society. One of the new lines that I've been using more and more frequently is how else do you have a diverse democracy except that people who disagree on some things deeply are able to partner on other things as well?
Question. Thank you. Our next question comes from Rob Locko with Howard G. Buffett Foundation.
Hey, Bill.
Rob Locko, good to hear your voice.
How are you, sir? I really enjoyed what you were talking about in terms of the track of history, the way that this values argument actually flows through American history and shows it's not an easy path. It reminded me of actually something that the president said in his second inaugural, where he was talking about the reason why America will win the sort of 21st century globalization age is because we have all the qualities that age will need, things like openness, diversity, capacity for risk, youth. And it was reminding me of a lot of the work that you've been doing on college campuses at the White House. And so I was wondering, between Acts of Faith and Sacred Ground, what has that experience taught you about the way we should be approaching this from a foreign policy perspective? And what do you see coming in terms of that next generation of leaders, in terms of that track of history? Do you feel like we're in good stead, or feel like there's more to be concerned about there?
I think that's thank you for that question, Rob. I think that's a terrific question. So I think that there's I'll go back to where I started, which is, the foreign policy discourse right now is dominated by two questions. And one is, will these emerging democracies, will they be able to build representative governments? Will the Christians and the various types of Muslims in Egypt be able to agree on a stable government and keep it going? And, will elections happen, and will they be fair, and will there be transitions of power, et cetera, et cetera? But the second is the economic question, which is, will Egypt, Tunisia, et cetera, be able to have economies that employ a reasonable number of their people, especially their large segments of young people? And I would say there's a third question that gets discussed a lot less, which is, again, will the diverse groups within those societies, whether they're diverse types of Muslims or whether they're Hindus and Muslims in India or whether they're Catholics and Protestants in Belfast, what are their relationships going to be with one another, right? And Iraq is a case study of this. It's unclear whether Sunnis, Shias, and Kurds in Iraq want to belong to the same nation or whether they effectively want separate Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish nations. It's pretty clear that many Kurds want a separate Kurdish nation. So the American example that communities who orient around religion differently can build a nation together is a remarkable example at a time when there's a lot of people who are not convinced about that around the world. To be able to say, those Sunnis and Shias are able to do it in the United States, those Muslims and Jews are able to do it in the United States, those Hindus and Buddhists are able to do it in the United States. In other words, there's nothing inevitable about being Hindu or Buddhist, which means that we're at each other's throats. It's simply asking the question, what kind of social, political, and economic conditions can we create to promote pluralism? I think the American example of that is hugely inspiring. Now, there's another side of that, which is when we violate that example by, you know, people calling what is a Muslim YMCA project a terrorist command center, or people saying that a Mormon shouldn't be president because his allegiance is to the church and not to the flag, or people saying an atheist can't be president, well, that stuff reverberates around the world at 10 times the volume. And I think that it removes the luster off the American example. So what I think we ought to be humble in the Teddy Roosevelt thing of it's not so much walk softly and carry a big stick, it's be a little bit quiet but show your example proudly. And I think the example of American pluralism at its best is as important in this era as it ever was.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from Satpal Singh with World Sikh Council.
Hi, thanks for a great presentation. For the forces of pluralism to defeat the forces of prejudice, it's important for the leaders of faith to actually work against prejudice. In your experience, how strongly do high-level religious leaders actually feel that they should do so? And actually voice their concern when their followers engage in a prejudicial act? And how can such action on part of religious leaders be encouraged?
Mr. Singh, thank you for your question, and thank you for joining. And I just have to say that your community has suffered unspeakably in the past year, Oak Creek and beyond, and I have personally been deeply inspired by how members of your community have stood up for the dignity of all Americans and respect for all identities, even while you have been victimized. So I want to thank you for that example and appreciate you very much for joining this call and asking this question. So in my book, Sacred Ground, I have a chapter called The Art of Interfaith Leadership, and I kind of hold up His Holiness the Dalai Lama as an example of an exemplary interfaith leader, somebody who is clearly deeply committed to his own tradition and deeply knowledgeable in it, but constantly seeking appreciative knowledge of other traditions and constantly telling articulating a narrative of the importance of interfaith cooperation, which he's done in a couple of books now. Toward a True Kinship of Faiths is one of those books. And then what I say is we can't rely if this is only the Dalai Lamas of the world, then we're in trouble because there just aren't that many of them. And I think that actually the bigger question right now is what can ordinary citizens like you and me do? And I think that there's a lot that we can do. As our communities, as our campuses, as our neighborhoods, as our hospitals become more and more religiously diverse, I don't think we should wait for papal encyclicals to engage in that diversity. I think what we have to do is be building interfaith cooperation along the lines of the model that I proposed earlier, the interfaith triangle, in these local places, on our campuses like we do at Interfaith Youth Corps, in seminaries like people like Josh Stanton is doing in New York City with the journal that he started there. The kind of work that everybody on this phone call is doing, I think, is really, really important. One of the things we say at Interfaith Youth Corps is that interfaith cooperation ought to be a social norm. It ought to have the same kind of normative value in America that multiculturalism does, that volunteerism does, that human rights does, that environmentalism does. And I think that's going to take a lot of us to step up and be leaders and build these bridges and work the interfaith triangle in our own communities.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from David Dalt with Christian Brothers University.
Ibu, thank you so much for your time and for this conversation. I want to go back to what you said a moment ago about the sort of Iraqi model of the splintering of nations into a Sunni community nation, a Shia community nation, and a Kurdish community nation, and you contrasted that with what you called the American example, which is the sort of ability for different religious communities to share a national identity. I was having a conversation a few weeks back with Jacques Berlinerblau, the author of the book How to Be Secular, and his thesis was that the way that America accomplishes this is by creating a neutral space that is explicitly non-religious. And I was wondering if you, in the public sphere, I was wondering if you would agree that that is sort of the way forward to sort of talk about the American example, or if you would articulate a different way of looking at the civic space that we share, instead of Berlinerblau's example of a non-religious neutral space, if you would characterize that differently.
So, you know, I know Jacques, and I think he's a great guy and a terrific scholar. I haven't actually read the book. I ought to do that before I comment on the book itself. But I think I would probably have a different model, right? And I think the model would be pluralism, which is to say we are a society that is neutral in the sense that it welcomes contributions from people and communities of all backgrounds, recognizing that those contributions are not neutral. Those contributions come from somewhere, and they come in large part from the inspiration of people's religious heritages. And I'll give you kind of an interesting example here, which is that Jacques writes his book from Georgetown University. So the university in which Jacques has his perch to write a book about the importance of secularism is a Jesuit university founded, if my history serves, in the late 18th century by Catholics in Maryland. Right? So it is another great example. Now, of course, there's a robust network of public universities in the United States. I was educated as one of them. It's a huge institutional contribution to America. But there are many, many private religious universities, one of which is the one that you're on. You're in Memphis, right, David?
Yeah, that's correct.
So a Christian brothers came to the United States, and they decided part of the way that we're going to be Catholic and American is to start institutions that reflect our heritage and inspiration and contribute to the common good of the United States. And I remember being at Christian Brothers University in Memphis 5 or 6 years ago, and I was doing a talk for Facing History. And one thing I don't remember is that you don't have a litmus test. You don't have a religious test for your students at Christian Brothers, right? In other words, any student from any background can come.
That is correct. Even though it's Catholic, we sort of have an all-comers policy in terms of the classroom, and we don't expect that people will be Catholic when they engage in the public conversation.
I think that in my view, that's the most dynamic energy of the United States, is that communities like yours, communities like the ones who founded Georgetown, come to the United States. They use the inspiration of their traditions to build institutions that serve everybody. And they, in that way, they get to be both sides of the hyphen at the same time. This doesn't mean that some dimensions of neutrality are unimportant. They're clearly important, and I think that the, you know, church-state separation, for example, a sense that the government doesn't give preference to one religious community over another when it comes to granting zoning or granting funding or anything along those lines, that's really, really important. So I think when it comes to the functioning of our government, neutrality is clearly important. When it comes to the richness of our civil society, I think the contributions of particular communities are paramount.
That distinction is very helpful. Thank you for taking the time to map that out.
Thank you.
Next question or comment?
Next question comes from Mohammed El-Sanusi with Islamic Society of North America.
Thank you so much, and thank you. Thank you, Ipo. It's always a pleasure to hear you addressing these critical issues here in our society. My question really, it's not a question, but it's really a comment. Earlier, I think Dr. Ubaid spoke about the issue of Islamophobia and the rising anti-Muslim sentiment and what the other interreligious communities have done. So I think we're, as a Muslim community, we're really very happy about what is going on here, particularly regarding the stand that the interreligious community made and came to support American Muslims and really to talk about the pluralism and diversity that Ipo was talking about. In fact, they created an organization called Shoulder to Shoulder, standing with American Muslims, upholding American values. And these are communities like the, you know, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, National Council of Churches, all the Jewish, denominations and other communities, Hindu communities. So I think this is the contribution that Ivo was talking about. I think it's great. But the question would be here, what the American Muslim community is doing actually to support interreligious communities, whether it is here at home or abroad. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that question. As I said, Mayor Bloomberg is a central character in this book because I was personally so moved by the risks that he took, right? The risks that he took to stand up for Cordoba House, the Ground Zero Mosque, at a time when it felt like every politician in America, from Nevada to North Carolina, was taking a stand against it for their own political gain. And here's Mayor Bloomberg hosting an iftar in Gracie Mansion and lifting up Daisy Khan. Here's Mayor Bloomberg giving a speech at the foot of the Statue of Liberty about the importance of welcoming the contributions of multiple communities. Here's Mayor Bloomberg tweeting out George Washington's famous letter to the Hebrew congregation of Newport, Rhode Island, that all deserve a like liberty. And one of the things that struck me in delving into writing about Mayor Bloomberg, and I, you know, looked at a variety of sources and talked to a number of people around him, and in fact saw him a week ago so I could thank him personally for the work that he did, was that Mayor Bloomberg had an experience of anti-Semitism, a really deep experience when he was a kid. His family was not allowed to purchase a home in Medford, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston, because they were Jewish, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And their Christian lawyer had to buy the home for them and sell it to them under the table because real estate agents wouldn't sell it to them directly. And at that time, young Michael Bloomberg makes a decision, not that no Jew will experience such discrimination in America again, but that nobody should ever experience that discrimination. And I think that that's the most American and Jewish and Muslim and Christian and humanist decision one can ever make, that nobody should experience discrimination. And frankly, right now, as the Muslim community is on its heels because of, you know, the defacement of mosques in Tennessee and because of opposition to mosques from San Diego to Staten Island and the bullying that our kids are experiencing in schools, I think that it makes sense for us to say, you know, how are we making sure that we Muslims have dignity in America and are able to live our faith freely as other Americans do? But I think that in not too long, we're going to have to ask what I think is a higher level American and Muslim question, which is, who are we standing up for, right? Do we raise our voices as loudly when there's anti-Mormon prejudice or anti-atheist prejudice or anti-gay prejudice as when there's anti-Muslim prejudice? And I think we ought to, and I think it's a Muslim and an American thing to do that.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question comes from Rahul Deep Gill with California Lutheran University.
Hi, Ibu. Thanks for your excellent overview of your excellent book. I have a two-part question, but I think you already answered the first part, which was about exporting the kind of active, engaged religious pluralism to some of the places that you mentioned in the early part of your talk. The second part of my question is the flip side of that. Where are some of the surprising examples of engaged and active pluralism from abroad that we can learn from in the United States?
Yeah, I think what great question. So thank you for that. By the way, congratulations on a terrific presentation. I've been circulating that to my staff here at Interfaith Youth Corps, and thank you for sharing that with us. Professor Gill, who's a professor at Cal Lutheran, just did a great presentation on the Sikh tradition of interfaith cooperation at a church near his home. I think that every nation has a narrative of interfaith cooperation, right? And I'm an American, and so I sing the American song of interfaith cooperation. But there's an Indian song from the Emperor Ashoka through the Emperor Akbar, through Vivekananda and Gandhi and Kabir and many others. There's a South African song, I'll never forget being in Cape Town, seeing Mandela speak in 1999 and having him point out to the Cape, to Robben Island, where he spent 27 years of his life in a prison cell and saying, I would still be in that cell if it wasn't for the Muslims and the Jews and the Christians and the Hindus and the traditionalists of South Africa defeating apartheid. I think that there's a beautiful story of interfaith cooperation in Egypt when Imam Ali, the first Shia Imam and the fourth of the rightly guided caliphs, the Rashidun, sends a letter to his governor in Egypt and says, all people there are your brothers in faith or your equals in creation. And I think it's important to, as Americans, I frankly think our first responsibility is to know our own history of interfaith cooperation, know that Thomas Jefferson owned a Quran and hosted the first iftar dinner, know that Benjamin Franklin built a hall in Philadelphia and said that the pulpit of this hall would be open to any preacher, including a representative from the Mufti of the Grand Mufti of Constantinople, preaching Islam to us. And I think we ought to have some literacy in the traditions of interfaith cooperation of other nations. And, you know, as an Indian, what happens, that tradition in India is particularly inspiring to me. And honestly, as an Indian, it's the violations of that tradition, whether it's anti-Muslim or anti-Hindu or anti-Sikh or anti-humanist violations are then even more hurtful to me.
Thank you. It's a beautiful answer.
Thank you very much. I think we have time, unfortunately, for just one last question.
Final question comes from Azeem Farooqi with Islamic Center of Rockland, New York.
Thank you very much. Dr. Patel, it's finally a pleasure to talk to you, at least. I am from Islamic Center of Rockland in New York. It's a county just outside of New York City. And I really truly believe that lack of knowledge about other religions is the cause of much suspicions and fear among us today. I'll just give you two examples. Last year, the Islamic Center of Rockland organized a symposium on three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And it was attended by 250 people. Most of them were from the Christian and Jewish churches and synagogues. And then we also did a documentary on violence against women, the Islamic point of view, with the Rockland Family Shelter. And it was a huge success. I'm really happy to see that that law is recently being passed on that. And as a result of that, the Temple Beth Torah in Rockland County asked me last month to come and give 6 classes on Islam, which I did, and it was a great success. And the local Catholic colleges here, as well as the churches, they are asking for me and other people to come and talk about, have a dialogue about the religion. So the points that you mentioned. Incidentally, I also want to point out one thing to that previous caller.
Hello?
Yes, I'm not sure what happened to that gentleman.
One moment, let me find his line.
Hello?
Sir, your line is now open.
Okay. I was just pointing out that in the last caller, the earlier caller was talking about harmony here, and I wanted to refer him to chapter 49, verse 13 of the Quran, which simply says that, O mankind, we have created you from a single pair of male and female and made you into nation and tribes that you may get to know one another. And I fully agree with you on your points that you mentioned earlier, respect for the other communities, relationship, and a commitment to creating a good community in the United States. Incidentally, I'm also from India, and in this last meeting, we had several of my Hindu friends attended the presentation as well at the Islamic Center of Rockland. and thank you for listening to me.
So thank you so much for that, and I think what you're talking about is an excellent example of knowledge doesn't drop from the sky or rise from the ground. We have to be vehicles of appreciative knowledge of our traditions and other traditions, and that's a big part of interfaith leadership. And so I congratulate you for the terrific work you're doing in being a vehicle for appreciative knowledge about Islam. And I would say, in kind of closing this, I think the way that this movement grows is all of us take on the responsibility of being interfaith leaders, and we weave that into our institutions and organizations and communities. And just like people have a sense of being environmentalists or human rights activists or civil rights activists, people ought to have a sense of being an interfaith leader. And the definition of an interfaith leader is somebody who can build understanding and cooperation between individuals and communities who orient around religion differently. And the way we do that well is we work the interfaith triangle. We are able to facilitate positive, meaningful relationships between people who orient around religion differently, and then we're able to spread appreciative knowledge of different traditions. So thank you, Arena, for having me. Thank you, friends, for joining. I hope that you found that this session was inspiring and illuminating, and I hope that that you find Sacred Ground, the book that this session was based off of, inspiring and illuminating as well.
Ibu, thank you very much for that, for your insights and your perspective, and I think I speak for all of us when I say that it was illuminating and inspiring, as usual, you are. So thank you for the work that you have done and continue to do. We look forward to reading this book as well as your next book, which I'm sure you're already working on.
I'm already breathless from this one still. So.
Okay, we'll give you another month off. Thanks to everyone for participating in this call. I hope that you will share the audio with your colleagues. We will be posting it in the next few days. This conference call series is part of our Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, and we appreciate your feedback and any suggestions you might have for topics or speakers or issues we should be covering in future calls. Please email us at outreach@cfr.org with ideas or anything else you would like to communicate to us. So thanks to all, and thank you, Ibu.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.